Welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and I'm joined by Katie Balls and James Forsyth. So James, this is quite a big week for Britain's negotiations over Brexit. What's happening?
Well, tonight Theresa May and David Davis are heading to Brussels for dinner with Jean-Claude Juncker and Michel Barnier and Juncker's chief of staff. Now, the last time Theresa May had dinner with this particular cast of characters, it ended up all over the German newspapers. Theresa May stormed into Downing Street and announced that, you know, this was proof of why the country must give her a majority because the Europeans are trying to interfere in our election. Now, that didn't work out quite as she intended. Now, the reason she's going is that there's a European Council on Thursday, at which it is expected that the Europeans will agree that there's been insufficient progress to move on to trade talks. I don't think Theresa May hopes that she's going to get sufficient progress to move on to trade, but I think she hopes that the Europeans might give some ground on transition, basically broadly indicating that they're all right with the UK's plan on this. And that they might suggest that, you know, we probably will get onto trade in December. The view in the Treasury is that we have to get onto the trade talks by the end of this year. Otherwise, lots of people will start triggering contingency plans to move their businesses out of the UK.
Katie, there's some debate this morning over whether this dinner is an emergency dinner or a long planned dinner.
Yeah, number 10 are insisting it's long planned. It's been in the diary for some time. I think the problem is it was first revealed quite late last night, and lots of people have since said that it's not been recorded anywhere. It's not in the Brussels calendar, it's not been on the Whitehall calendar. So it seems as though is the Brits, after saying the ball was in the EU's court, perhaps they're now, you know, saying we've got something else to put in your court, we're going to come to you. But either way, I think because we've had the opposition, for example, saying that Britain should up the talks. I think it will generally be quite well received that there is more dialogue. I don't think that many people will be critical of this.
I think the crucial, as I understand it, one of the issues here is that the UK side think that there's basically a deal done on citizens' rights. And they think that the EU doesn't want to admit that because the EU doesn't want to admit that the real stumbling block is the money. So I think what we will see at this dinner is a UK offer on citizens' rights. You know, basically say for you, right, what more do you want? Here's what we'll get to. There's a very technical question, and I'm now going to get the wrong way around, of whether the UK courts should agree to take note of or to pay attention to ECJ judgments on European citizens' rights as it develops to cover the rights of EU citizens here. If the ECJ's jurisprudence changes, how would UK courts reflect that? And I think, so I presume there'll be some clarity on that. And I think there, because I think the UK side are trying to say, look, come on, this issue, the only issue holding us up really is the money, and we're prepared to pay the money, but we need to know, we don't want to pay the money until we know what kind of trade deal we're getting at the end of it.
And Katie, how are Conservative MPs reacting to what's going on at the moment? They weren't very happy at the start of last week when Theresa May admitted that the ECJ would have jurisdiction during the transition period. How are they now? Was it a brief moment of unhappiness?
Well, I think there's just widespread, there's a range of feelings, because obviously we have people in the Brexit camp who worry about the ECJ and there's worry there's too many concessions. But then you also have people on the Remain side, so people like Anna Soubry, who worry that a no-deal scenario is now looking quite likely. And they seem as though they might join Labour when, if ever, the EU withdrawal bill comes back to Parliament to block these things.
When you say join Labour, do you mean working with the front bench? Because John McDonnell was asked about this at the weekend and he gave a sort of vague-ish answer. Who are they going to be working with in Labour? McDonnell, Starmer, Chukwuemeka?
Well, this is a dilemma for them because we saw yesterday on the Andrew Marr show John McDonnell suggest that Labour would table an amendment which meant that you could not reach a no-deal scenario. Since then, a number of Labour backbenchers have suggested that John McDonnell ought to distance himself from this because it's a lot less likely that Conservative MPs are going to work with the Labour front bench to achieve something that looks like they're just joining the opposition than if it looks like it's a backbench group of a joint aim. So I think how many Tory MPs decide to go with them will depend a lot on how Labour handle this. If it looks like Corbyn McDonnell, less likely.
One thing I genuinely don't understand about this ruse is Parliament is obviously sovereign, but it's not sovereign over the other 27 EU countries. And what I don't get is, having triggered Article 50, the the UK, unless something happens, leaves on the 30th of March 2019. I don't see how Parliament, because Parliament isn't in the room in those negotiations, how does Parliament stop the UK from leaving without a deal if Theresa May walks out of the talks? I just don't follow how this works legally.
Has that been explained by the Labour front bench, Katie?
Oddly enough, Isabel, Labour's position doesn't seem to make complete coherent sense at the moment because they've changed it so many times.
Goodness me.
But the implication of the current position seems to be that if there wasn't a deal, things would perhaps stay as they were. But how that works when you have Article 50 and, you know, this clock ticking isn't really clear, and that is the problem. They will have to explain, because there's more than just, you know, as James says, one country in the room, how that would actually be accepted if it would be.
I mean, Isabel, you've written the book on Parliament.
Available in all good bookshops next year.
My understanding is that, you know, while Parliament obviously controls supply, and Parliament obviously has to ratify treaties, the making of a treaty is still an executive power. I don't see how, but what I'm trying to say in a convoluted way is, I don't see how Parliament gets itself into the room short of removing the government.
Well, let's move on from confusion about Parliament and what it can and can't do, because I suspect that actually a lot of the debate over Parliament having a say has managed to elide that point about whether Parliament would what the sort of say Parliament could actually have when, as you say, a treaty is an executive power. Let's just look at the domestic political scene briefly. James, we've got the budget coming up and we're starting to hear rumours and briefings about what sort of budget that might be. And it seems to be swinging backwards and forwards from being a very modest budget where Philip Hammond doesn't want to get into trouble to Philip Hammond wanting to do something radical that will definitely work and won't get him into trouble.
I think the most dangerous thing for him to do is to do very little. Because if he does very little, everyone will say the government's out of ideas. Hammond himself is out of ideas. Where's the imagination? Where's the radicalism? I think it would be a very good thing if he was more radical. I also think if you are more radical, you can get away with some small missteps because there's a bigger picture to concentrate on. You can genuinely turn around and say, well, actually, let's look at this. I think this question of the presentational issue shows how what on the Sunday papers was meant to be an income tax break for younger workers has turned into, by today's Telegraph, a tax on the old. And I mean, that will make Tory MPs with memories fresh of the whole dementia tax debacle nervous. I think the biggest thing, though, which I think he needs to do is house building. I mean, Theresa May is having all the house builders into Downing Street on Tuesday. You know, the time for this kind of stuff is long gone. It needs to be a proper, radical, and that would make a much bigger difference, I think, to young people overall than playing around with their national insurance contributions or the like.
And Katie, we've heard some suggestions about what that house building might involve. What are they?
Yes, they have a range of options, direct commissioning and also building on the Greenbelt. But building on the Greenbelt is something which, again, is likely to annoy some of their core voter base. So it's this balancing act. And
so you're going to tax older people and then build on their view.
Yeah, so maybe bring down the price of their own
it's
property.
Definitely radical.
And also they're looking at, again, tuition fees. Classic. And I think there was a report in the Sunday Times suggesting that David Davis is urging the Chancellor to write off historic student debt, something that only recently the Conservatives were attacking Labour on for suggesting they would do, but not doing because it was completely uncosted.
And James, that story in the Sunday Times about David Davis was fascinating because it was, well, as much as we can guess at someone's sources, it didn't seem to be something that had sort of been passed on by Chinese whispers. It did seem pretty directly from David Davis to be briefing that he wants this in public almost.
Yes, but I think what he's saying is something slightly different from what he's been interpreted as saying, which I think what he's saying is lots of these people will never pay the money back, right? They're never going to earn enough to pay the money back. So why are we still telling them that they're in debt rather than just admitting they're never going to earn the money back and saying that that debt is cancelled? I mean, I think that, you know, I think as Katie was defending winning debates at the Cambridge Union on tuition fees the other night, and I think, you know, I think the argument on tuition fees is just been incredibly badly made. And one of the ways it's been incredibly badly made is a failure to point out that part of the problem is obviously some graduates should be paying more because they earn a huge amount more over their working lifetime because of a university degree. You know, I think so someone with an Oxbridge degree earns on average £1 million more over their working lifetime than someone without a degree at all. You know, it strikes me as entirely fair that those people contribute some of that money towards the cost of education. Because the universities have I have not used this ability to vary fees, and nearly all courses cost £9,000. You're in a situation where courses where the earnings premium are huge are charging the same as courses where the earning premium is negligible or even possibly negative. I think on house building, the way to do this is everything should be, and the government don't do this on lots of things, which they should be doing, everything should be wrapped up in the banner of making Brexit a success. I think if you did that with house building, including some reforms that would allow you to build on the green belt, I think some people who might naturally not like the idea, if they were told that this was part of the push to make Brexit work, would be much more sympathetic to the idea.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Katie. And a reminder that you can listen to all of our podcasts on the iTunes store, and this one is called Coffee House Shots. We have a special offer for podcast listeners, 12 issues of The Spectator for £12 and a special limited edition Spectator moleskin notebook. Just go to spectator.co.uk/pod offer. Thanks for listening.